Brothers in the Dharma, we are having a look into the life of Milarepa. What did we call the retreat in the end? What was the full title?
Devotion,
Discipleship and Lineage. And I hope the devotion and the discipleship and lineage are coming across, because I realise that I haven't entirely addressed perhaps those words directly. And of course, we're also trying to relate Milarepa's life and songs to ourselves, our own practice, training for ordination or being order members. And of course, Milarepa is an example of extraordinary, absolutely one-pointed, total dedication. There's really nothing else that he wants to do other than practice the Dharma in retreat all the time. And yesterday we heard about him, you know, going back home, discovering how his old house was completely destroyed, and all the fields were covered in weeds, and discovering his mother's bones, and you know, his sister had gone off, disappeared begging. I mean, truly extraordinary kind of tragedy. I find it very interesting reading the accounts of Milarepa's sorrows. He really does suffer. It's very, very personal. Dukkha is always and impermanence and loss is always delivered very, very personally. But one of the things about Milarepa's life, the way he sees into it, the way he has an insight into it, is though it is very personal, it's seen as a universal truth. In that sense, it's not personal. He transcends the personal. I find this very, very interesting if we're talking about an insight into dukkha and talking about becoming liberated from dukkha. Yes, we feel it very personally, but we've got to go further than that and realise it is not personal. It's something that happens, well, it happens to everybody. And we need to, you know, wake up to that truth, to follow the path to nirvana. And Milarepa does. He really goes into intensive solitary retreat. The early chapters in the songs of Milarepa and the life of Milarepa are all about that, and you know, Bhante's done these seminars on the Red Rock Jewel Valley and the Song of a Yogi's Joy, and you see all these different experiences he has of intense loneliness, of being attacked by demons, but at every turn he takes everything onto the path. Whatever arises, he takes it as a teaching. And there's that wonderful story in the life Milarepa that impressed Bhante very, very strongly when he read it in India when he was a young man. How he goes outside of his retreat place because of his inferior food and clothing during this long period of practice. It caused my feet to become calloused. I slipped on a stone at the entrance of my cave and fell. The handle of the pot fell off and the vessel rolled down the mountainside. I ran to catch it, but the pot cracked and from within appeared a single mass of green nettle residue, shaped just like the pot itself. This demonstrated that all composite things are impermanent, and reflecting on it, I understood it as an exhortation to practice. Feeling a sense of amazement and renunciation, I sang this song. I once had a pot, now I do not. This case illustrates every composite thing. It exemplifies human bodies of leisure and opportunity. This being so, I, Mila, the yogin, will press on in my practice without distraction. This clay pot, so important, the whole of my wealth, this clay pot, so important, the whole of my wealth becomes my guru in the moment it breaks, teaching impermanence. How amazing. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. The pot becomes his teacher. He worships this broken pot. This is the guru. This is Marpa, become all things. And I think somebody in one of the groups was talking about life being a guru. Well, yes, life is a guru. Life is always teaching. This is what they say in the tradition. You intensify your guru devotion to a particular person. But through that, you're trying to see everything is teaching you. The whole of existence is teaching you the Dharma. And Milarepa exemplifies this with his pot. The whole of his wealth. The whole of his wealth. In the moment of breaking, that pot becomes the teacher. Now, I wonder if we feel that when our computer, our iPad, our iPhone goes wrong. Do we praise it as the guru, or are we immediately irritated with Apple or whoever it is? Or in my case, running down to the office when the internet connection goes down in desperation. At, I don't praise it as my guru. I just want to smash the thing up. Anyway, that's. But anyway, it's. But that pot, the whole of his wealth. You can even be attached to a pot. It seems, you know, in retreat. So he's seeing the Dharma everywhere through the intensity of his practice. So he wanders after long periods in retreat from place to place, finding other places to meditate. A lot of these come out of dreams where he's sort of directed to go somewhere else. And obviously he starts to get into communication with people. He's what's known as a kusulu, a wandering beggar yogin with absolutely nothing, very, very simple life, absolutely bare essentials, just with his cotton robe, going from place to place. He must have been pretty weird looking. When Aloka painted this image, it is based on a traditional iconography. That pose of the yogis, very often he's depicted as singing, putting one hand to the ear. It's also apparently some sort of yogic practice, that this is yogic asana that it's depicted. But when Aloka painted it, he found the traditional faces of Milarepa rather, well, they want to make him look like a sort of 16-year-old bodhisattva, and it doesn't seem to go with Milarepa when you actually read the life of Milarepa. And what Aloka did, he looked at photographs of old Tibetan yogins, really lined and earthy. It looks as though they're kind of carved out of stone, some of them. And so that's why he's got that face. And sometimes Milarepa is mistaken for being a ghost or a demon. You know, he's such a weird looking character. When people come across him, they're quite sort of disturbed and freaked out, you know, because he's just getting on with it. In Indian tradition, the enlightened tantric yogin is often likened to a ghost. You know, just sort of comes through the village and does something, has an incredible effect, and then moves on. So Milarepa has this kind of quality, but he also seems to have been very friendly. So even though he's very strange, he would interact with the people that he met. And what you find developing in his life, not only is there a kind of community of yogins, arepas, cotton-clad ones, who start to become his disciples, you get a wider community developing. People who, they're not going to live that kind of life themselves, but they want to be around this man. They want to be around these practitioners. They learn the Dharma from them. They even probably take up maybe basic forms of meditation and puja and so on. And they want to support them. They feel a sense of meaning supporting people like Milarepa. So there's an early story of his encounter with some people. It's around the time that he first meets his great disciple Rechunpa. He comes to this place, I think it's called Guntung, as I recall, and he sees some people building a house. People in the local community are coming together to build a house, and he asks for food. He begs for food. He just asks, "Can you give me some food?" And they said, "Well, we're busy. We're really busy. You seem to have a lot of time on your hands. Why don't you help us?" You know, so they're you know, they're not going to give him any food. You know, he's just this wandering vagrant. He's got lots of leisure. So, you know, why don't you join in, you know, doing some building work? They don't even say they'll give him any food for it, but why don't you join in? And Milarepa just says, yes, I have got a lot of leisure because I've finished building my house. I've finished building my house. And, well, they what do you mean you've finished building your house? So he sings, first is the stable foundation of faith. Second is the high wall of virya, effort, energy. Third is the wide wall of meditative concentration. Fourth is the excellent roof of prajna. These four make up the house I've built. It's a house that will forever stand. Your worldly house will only deceive. You should give up this prison right now. And supremely confident is our Milarepa. And of course, they're really intrigued by this, because he's obviously a very friendly man. He's a bit unusual looking, and he's singing a good song. He had a great voice, probably a lovely melody that he's made up for the song. But he's talking about the building of another kind of house, the creation of another kind of dwelling, not something that can arise and pass away, and which, as he says, you can end up being deceived by and imprisoned by. Because, of course, a house, well, you have people in a house, don't you? You have people with all sorts of habits and attitudes and so on. So you can feel very trapped in a house. A house can seem a wonderful thing, you know, if you've saved up for it and you've got it, but then there's the mortgage, then there are the repairs, then there's all the kind of interactions. Who owns the house in the end if you bought it with somebody else, and so on and so forth? So although we all have to live in dwellings, of course we do, there are problems that can go with it, including identity and so on and so forth. Milarepa is saying, actually, you need to be building another kind of house. It's the if you like, the house of the Dharma. That's what you're building. This is a very old tradition, actually, of speaking like this. You get the Buddha with Farmer Bharadvaja talking like this, taking their values and describing and using that to describe their own values. Well, he goes even a bit further than that, because the people are, as I say, are kind of impressed, and they want to know more. They want to know about Milarepa's farm, about his wealth, about his family, his wife, his children. They want to know what, you know, he's sung about the house he's finished. Well, what else has he got going for him? So what we're going to be hearing about and studying a bit this afternoon is Milarepa's, if you like, spiritual rebirth. We've talked a lot about going forth. We've talked a lot about renunciation. We've talked a lot about the giving up of the world. Well, what replaces that? And I'm conscious in talking like this, of course, well, we all live in houses of one kind or another. We all own things and possess things of one kind or another. And I'm not, by the way, saying to you all, well, let's all be like Milarepa and give all that up and do the things that he's advocating. You know, that would be very, very hard for us. Well, and maybe not for some of the younger ones among, because that's a very single, like Frankie. No pressure, Frankie. But what I want to do here is to try and evoke, through using Milarepa's teaching, that this sort of unfolding and emergence how can we describe it? Of, I don't want to use the word inner, but the total recreation of self and world. That's what Milarepa is describing. That's what the Buddhist life is. In our own system of practice, we talk about, you know, building things up through the stages of integration and positive emotion, building up a very, very positive sense of self, if you like, a very positive new kind of building house, if you like, recreating ourself and world. But that has to die in the flames of shunyata. That all, no matter how good that is, that all has to dissolve away, so that the transcendental, if you like, for want of a better word, heavy, single inverted commas, self, and he calls it that in the original lecture, can emerge, the Buddha, the Bodhisattva. And so this is what Milarepa is really going to be describing. So he sings a song to them, and I'll read you the translation of the song, and then I'll go through each of its elements and see what we can learn from it. The Alaya consciousness is the good earth. The inner instructions are the seeds that are sowed. Achievement in meditation is the sprout that grows, and the three kayas of the Buddha are the ripened crop. These are the four lasting mainstays of heavenly farming. Your worldly farming, delusive and deceiving, is merely the slave labor of the hungry. Without hesitation, discard it. The fine treasury of Shunyata, the wealth of the transcendental jewels, the happiness of living by the ten virtues, and the undefiled great bliss. These four heavenly jewels are my wealth, which will last forever. Your worldly jewels and possessions are delusive and deceiving. Like deceptive magic spells, they lead you astray. Without any hesitation, discard them. The father and mother Buddhas are my parents. The immaculate Dharma is my own mouth. The assembly of the Sangha are my cousins and nephews. And the Dharmapalas are my friends and supporters. These four are my lasting heavenly kinsmen. Your worldly kinsmen are deceitful and will only deceive. Without hesitation, renounce all ephemeral associates. My wife's ancestors are those who have gone to bliss, and she is expert in cooking up the bliss clarity. The two in one is her glowing, lustrous skin, and she wears the clothing of experience and realization. This is my heavenly and lasting wife. Delusive and deceiving are your worldly consorts. They are but temporary friends, inclined to quarrel. Without hesitation, discard them. Awareness is my newborn babe. The signs of accomplishment are my infant. Understanding and realization is my child. And the grown youth who holds the Dharma is my young companion. These four are my lasting heavenly sons. Your worldly offspring are delusive and deceitful. Without hesitation, renounce them. Good workers of Guntung, and I, the yogin Milarepa, through the connection we have made through our conversation here, may we meet again in the glorious land of Urgyen. Wonderful song. Banti thought that probably people in the old Tibet, or Tibet at that time, probably knew quite a lot of Dharma. Already they would have been, you know, would have been known a bit. So that's why Milarepa could sing to them in this way. So let's just go through some of the things in this song and see what we can learn from it. So the Alaya consciousness is the good earth. The inner instructions are the seeds that are sowed. So I talked the other day about the Alaya Vijnana, the store consciousness, and how there's this notion in Yogacara Buddhism that all of the traces, the effects of our intentional actions, whether skillful or unskillful, are deposited in this stream, this torrent called the Alaya, which we're not conscious of. It's not something that you can actually be aware of. But it holds all of our deeds. And at a certain point, as when conditions are right, they flare up and we experience the consequences of our previous actions. It's a way of explaining the way karma works. In Bhante's exposition of this, which is brilliant, he says, don't try and do metaphysics with it. Don't speculate. It's more of a sort of metaphor to describe how karma works. Take it seriously. Because I think it is true. Nothing is lost. Nothing is lost. It's very risky to think that you're going to get round stuff that you've done. Very, very risky behaviour. But he speaks of it very, very positively here. He speaks of the Alia Vijnana as it were, underpinning the high revolution. He's still using that sort of language. Because it carries all of our skillful efforts, all of our efforts, all of our aspirations in the directions of enlightenment. Nothing is lost. Yes, we can talk about the unskillful, but we've done enough of that. Let's concentrate on the positive. Let's concentrate on the skillful. You know, this is, do you remember that early lecture, that the image that a Hindu teacher, I think, of Bhante's gave of the 20th blow on the rock? That's what the Buddhist life, the spiritual life is like. You can't see the effect of the first 19 blows, but they're having an effect. They're breaking the rock, but it's the 20th you break it. So it's the same with us. We can't always see the effects of our skillful action, of the efforts that we're making. But keep going. Something is happening. The seeds are being deposited in the good earth of the Alia. They will start to grow. He uses this expression, the inner instructions, the inner teachings. What Milarepa is getting at there is something that he's trying to get at. Bhante reads this as the instructions, the teachings that are really going in. Really going in. That you've really made your own. You've really made your own. I made that point about the importance of repetition. Of going over things again and again. And of course, if there are particular teachings that you really respond to, well, really dwell on them. You have a really emotional response to, you know, providing it is good quality dharma and not some, you know, soft focus, you know, new agey stuff. I'm talking about the real thing. You know, but if there is a teaching, no matter how difficult it might be, that really you have a real feel for, well, of course, that means you're going to be involved in that little teaching, emotionally involved in it. Well, dwell on it. Make it your own. Make it go in more and more deeply. So yes, really take the teaching in. In Tibetan Buddhism, they make a lot of what they call the precept of the teacher, the essential instruction of the teacher. This is a very, very pithy bit of advice where the general dharma is applied to you personally in your particular situation. It's come out of deep communication. But very often people find that what they hear from their Kalyana Mitras, or if they've gone for a little meeting with Bhante or something like that, has a very particular kind of force for them. It goes in very deeply and they live by it, you know, from then on. It might be something that the Buddha has said, might be a teaching from the Buddha, but it's come through somebody who has real emotional weight for them. I was talking with Bhante recently, and he told me something that often happens, which made a deep impression on me. I'd heard a rumour that, not a rumour, it was from a good source, that he had even very critical things said about him, read to him. Not just nice things said to him, but critical things, even quite strongly critical things. And I said, well, why do you do that? How do you do that? Why do you do that? Because I'd find that so horrible. I mean, any kind of criticism of me, I get very upset by. So why on earth do you do that? And he said, well, actually, I'm not bothered about anything said about me. That's fine. He said, what I'm concerned about is the order, and I want to know the worst. I want to know the worst. But I'm very confident in the order and the way it's going, he said. But no, I'm not bothered about me. And I said, but how have you done that? Have you trained to do that? Because I'm very bothered about what's said about me. Much too bothered. Morbidly bothered about what's said about me. And he said, well, yes, I have trained. He said, when I was younger, he said, if I was praised, I'd think, next time it will be blame. And when I was praised, I think, when I was blamed, I think, oh, next time I'll be praised. So he said, I always did that whenever I was told things. Not long after that, I was reading the Dhammapada in the section on the spiritually mature, which of course Bhante has translated and memorized when he was a young man. And it says, as a solid rock cannot be overturned by the wind, so the spiritually mature person, the wise person, is unmoved by praise or blame. And when I first read that, I thought, well, that's just a fruit of something. I wonder if Bhante took it as a saying to meditate on when he was a young man. Well, that made a very, very strong impression on me because of my own, you know, being bothered about praise and blame far too much. I thought, well, my teacher has practiced like this. He's told me about this, about what he's done. I need to take that right in. I need to take that right in to the Alia, to the good earth. I need to sow the seed of that teaching deeply in me so that I am not moved by praise and blame and I can do the right thing. Notice in that conversation with Bhante, his only concern is for others, for the order, not himself. Well, I need to practice like that. So make the Dharma your own. Take it into you. And achievement in meditation, says Milarepa, is the sprout that grows. Achievement in meditation is the sprout that grows. So this is quite interesting. He's talking about meditation as a sprout. You know, the little sprout coming up out of the good earth. You sow the seeds of instruction. You meditate. There's some achievement, but it's only a sprout. And as you know, sprouts can be very, very easily killed off by frost, by, you know, people treading on them. So you might have achieved something in meditation. You might have some dhyana. You might even have some flashes of a little bit of insight. But don't assume that it is, you know, the fully grown crop and fruit. It might only be a little sprout. And tend those sprouts of meditation achievement. Really tend them. Really look after them. Because they represent transformation. But only partial transformation, not total transformation. This is shamatha. It's not, you know, full irreversibility and insight. And don't get carried away with it. And tend them. And take them and notice them. Notice them. I often tell a story about a meditation retreat I did here with Kamala Shila. And Kamala Shila is a very, very good meditation interviewer because he can be quite fierce, quite direct. And I went in to him and he said, tell me about your meditation. And I said, well, it's rubbish. It's just rubbish. My meditation's awful at the moment. And he said, no, that doesn't tell me anything. I want you to tell me what happens in your meditation, everything that's happened. So I talked about this and this. And he said, you've just told me about that moment of concentration, that moment of metta-bhavana, that moment of inspiration, that moment of imagination. He said, they might be short-lived, they might be quite dilute, but they are your growing points, and you need to attend to them. What I'd been doing was basically thinking that, you know, because I wasn't noticing these very, very positive moments, I was just writing off my whole meditation as just a mess. And he was saying, tend these shoots. These shoots in your meditation. These are your growing points. Concentrate on them. It's very, very helpful advice. So we need to tend the shoots of meditation achievement. Doesn't matter how weak they are, how unconcentrated they are. Notice them, meditate on them, and they'll grow. Sure enough, on that retreat, I ended up having some very, very good meditations indeed, thanks to Kamala Shila's advice. So yes, tend the sprouts in meditation and they'll grow and grow. Well, in the end, Milarepa talks about the ripened crop that comes out of the seeds and the shoots is nothing other than the Trikaya of the Buddha. The three kayas, the Nirmanakaya, the Sambhogakaya and the Dharmakaya. In the end, if you tend the shoots of meditation, you attain... the total transformation of the entire psychophysical system. Buddha enlightenment in body, speech and mind. This is what the Trikaya represent. This is the aim of all Buddhist practice, actually a total transformation of body, speech and mind. The Nirmanakaya is enlightenment in body. It's the enlightened, it means being a fully enlightened presence in the world. Completely spontaneous with compassion. The fully compassionate presence, able to give the Dharma absolutely appropriately to whoever you meet. That's what we're aiming to do in transforming our body. The fully enlightened, compassionate, spontaneously compassionate presence, able to give the Dharma absolutely precisely and appropriately to whoever we're with. The speech is transformed into Sambhogakaya, very mysterious way of describing Buddhahood. Sambhoga means that dimension of the Buddha which is mutual enjoyment, mutual bliss. There's always something going on in the Buddha where he's totally blissful and always enjoying the emerging enlightenment or even the full enlightenment in others, and in turn being enjoyed by others. This is how it's connected with communication. You see this with the Buddha himself. You see his pleasure at communicating the Dharma. You see his pleasure at people up opening and unfolding. That's what he exists for. And of course, there are deeper mystical dimensions being pointed to with the Sambhogakaya. You know, these visionary experiences of enlightenment. So we're aiming to transform our speech into this. And then we're transforming the mind into the vast, completely indescribable, inconceivable Dharmakaya. That's the Buddha's body of reality. You don't take these terms bodies literally. They're not like bodies stacked up on one another. It's more like dimensions, if you like. And, you know, when we practice the Dharma, when we're devoted to the Buddha, we're moving into deeper and deeper dimensions of experience of the Buddha. But yes, we're transforming our body, speech and mind into Buddhahood. And of course, this is symbolized every day when we come in and we stoop the shrine, when we worship the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, we then chant Om Ah Hum. What we're doing with those mantras, Om Ah and Hum, we're dedicating our body, speech and mind to being transformed into the tree kaya of the Buddha. The potential for enlightenment is in every part of us. It's not just an abstract thing. In every part of us, there's the potential to become Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, Dharmakaya. Wow, that's what we're trying to do. One of the really important things about talking about enlightenment in this way, which is very, very particular to the Tantras, but it's there to all in all of Buddhism, but the Tantra bringing out, the Tantra's criticism of Buddhism is that it's far too mental. Far too mental. It's too heady. In a way, they're returning to the early days of Buddhism, actually. It's got to be tangible. It's got to be practical. It's got to be concrete. And it's something that really bedevils, I think, contemporary Buddhism. Too many Buddhists are far too in their heads. They know everything. You know, shunyata, not self. But it doesn't mean anything. It's not actually coming into bodily experience. And I don't mean by that, you know, how you move your big toe or the way you suck a raisin. I don't mean like that. I mean coming into the living presence and activity of kindness and awareness in relation to whoever you're with and whatever you're doing. This is the sort of project of the Vajrayana. But it's the project of the Buddha himself. I mean, the Buddha lived very physically in outside. Born under a tree, enlightened under a tree, parinirvana under a tree. He was very rarely inside. Very, very physical, his enlightenment. So that's the what he calls these are the four lasting mainstays of heavenly farming, and not the ordinary farming, which is the slave labour of the hungry. which he says, well, discard that, do this other kind of farming. So then he comes on to, what's his wealth? Well, it's nothing less than the fine treasury of shunyata. The fine treasury of shunyata, emptiness. Well, this is an incredible way of talking. Shunyata as a treasury, a great hoard of wealth. It gets us away from thinking, again, very abstractly about the idea of emptiness and any kind of notion of something nihilistic, which again is the great danger, I think, in these teachings of emptiness and not self. People can interpret them terribly nihilistically. But the teaching of shunyata, and especially Milarepa's teaching here, he's saying that shunyata, emptiness, is, how can we say, what that's really describing is unlimited and infinite possibility and potential. When you actually wake up to the emptiness of all things, the conditioned nature of all things, the unfixed nature of all things, it means that absolutely anything is possible. Buddhahood is possible, therefore it's a treasury. Therefore that realization is a treasury. You even get in the Mahayana attempts to try and indicate this. There's a bodhisattva called Gagana Gunja, which means the sky treasury, bodhisattva. The sky treasury. It's as if this idea, there's this vast sky, this vast space, out of which anything can come. That's what shunyata really is. Don't let people tell you any different from that. Or you get the notion of dharma dhatu, the realm of reality. Absolutely everything is shunyata. That means it's the realm of reality, out of which anything can emerge. Anything that can emerge. You get a real feeling of this when you do the six element meditation, which is usually given when you're leading up to ordination and you train in it after ordination. It's called a spiritual death practice. But when you do it, when you do the practice, yes, there is a real giving up of all identification with the elements in your experience, earth, water, fire, air, and space. You give up that. You even give up any identification with any notion of consciousness. And what you notice is this tremendous openness. I mean, it's an almost unbearable, the openness that opens up. Absolutely no boundaries, no limits. It's not nothing, but you can't actually say what it is. It's just this vast opening. And of course, it's out of that that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas start to emerge, out of that treasury of shunyata. So that's the wealth that we need. The wealth of realizing that there is nothing fixed. We are not fixed. Anything is possible. Everything is possible. Enlightenment is possible. So then Milarepa says, he talks about the wealth of the transcendental jewels, the Lokuttara jewels. Well, this is the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. The Buddha, Dharma and Sangha are expressions of emptiness. They're expressions of reality. They're nothing other than that. And you know, the Buddha is the living embodiment of someone who's realized that unlimited nature. The Dharma is nothing other than Pratichasamutpada Shunyata. It's the application of that to a path of practice that you can rely on that leads to that unlimited nature. And the Sangha are those who've begun to realize that in their inner experience, and especially they're realizing that in seeing through the distinction of self and other. So you have these very strong bonds of spiritual friendship and community, and being on the path together to that full realization of the unlimited state of Buddhahood. That's, so you go for refuge to them. Of course you do. You can't. They're the most reliable things because they're founded in emptiness, the treasury of emptiness. And then Milarepa talks about the happiness of living by the 10 virtues. This is his will. So this is the 10 precepts. This is the 10 precepts that we take at ordination. The 10 precepts themselves actually come out of emptiness because they're based on the truth of the Dharma. They're not arbitrary. They're natural morality. They're a morality for all times and all places because they're based on the truth. They're based on the truth of Pratichasamutpada, therefore the truth of emptiness. Bhante describes them himself in the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, which is one of the greatest Dharma books ever written, as 10 great pillars made of precious jewels. 10 great pillars made of different precious jewels. And when you actually look into his exposition of these 10 precepts, just take the first precept, the most fundamental precept, after talking about the sort of basic observation of abstaining from harming living beings. He inquires into why that is so important. Again, he arrives at shunyata. He arrives at reality by talking about, quoting Shantideva especially, and seeing through the distinction between self and other. That's why you need to treat others well, because if you harm them, well, you're negating your fundamental solidarity with all life. You're breaking that fundamental link between all life, because in reality, that is, we are in complete solidarity with one another. We are interlinked with one another. So any harm that you do is breaking that. It's an offence against shunyata. It's an offence against the real. So, of course, he derives great happiness by living by these 10 great jewels, the 10 precepts. And he has the happiness of undefiled great bliss. This is in Gama Chang's translation, the usual translation that we have. It's described as the bliss of non-outflow. The bliss, the anashrava bliss. The bliss, the ashravas are the poisonous fluxes, the poisonous tendencies that keeps us linked with samsara. Fundamentally, they're to do with craving and attachment. Well, in Milarepa, there is no outflow. There's nothing flowing out to grab and pull in. And that is experienced as undefiled great bliss, enormous happiness. Again, it's the bliss that comes from shunyata, because you've seen through. There's nothing to grasp, nothing to get hold of. And he says, well, your world, these four heavenly jewels and wealth, they'll last forever. And worldly jewels will just deceive you. Then he goes on talking about his parents and family. So the father and mother Buddhas are my parents. The father and mother Buddhas are my parents. The father and mother Buddhas. Some people might not be too sure about having father and mother Buddhas, but of course he's referring to the Yab-Yum forms, these forms of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in union. And of course what they're symbolizing, they're not really two figures. This is quite important to understand. They're a very graphic symbolism of the union of skillful means and wisdom. The male form being skillful means, compassion, and the female form being wisdom or prajna. What Milarepa is saying, in other words, he is the son of compassion and wisdom. He has been reborn out of wisdom and compassion. He is born of them. He's no longer an ordinary human being. He looks like an ordinary human being. He looks like a very weird ordinary human being. But that's not his real nature. That's not his real lineage. His real lineage is going back to the Buddhas of wisdom and compassion. You don't need to meditate on a Yab-Yum form to experience this. The Buddha on his own, the Bodhisattvas on their own, the Buddhas on their own are the embodiment of wisdom and compassion. But what you're doing after ordination, when you meditate on the Buddha and Bodhisattva form, what you're looking to do through that is to be reborn of that form. You're becoming a new person, an entirely new being through meditating on that form. So why it's so important that when you come to receiving initiation, mantra initiation at the time of ordination, that it's a figure that you really love, that you really have a very, very deep resonance with, that you really have a strong response to the beauty of the form. Because you need to really engage with that form if you're going to be transformed by that form and be reborn like that form. He goes on, he says, the immaculate Dharma is my own mouth. It's an interesting thing to say, as he's talked about his parents being wisdom and compassion. But then my Dharma is my own mouth. Well, I don't quite see how this follows on, but doesn't matter. What he perhaps he's saying is, well, because I'm born of wisdom and compassion, well then, whatever I say, whatever I sing, whatever comes out of here is Dharma. What an amazing thing to be able to say. Spontaneously, naturally. You know, I know what comes out of my mouth isn't definitely not always Dharma, by any means, even giving a Dharma talk. But he's saying that my mouth is Dharma. My mouth is Dharma. Very, very, you know, very, very graphic. So this is what we can do. You know, when we're reborn of wisdom and compassion, our mouth, everything will be Dharma. It doesn't mean that we'll be preaching Buddhism to everybody all the time in a boring way. We might not be talking about Buddhism at all, but it's still Dharma. It's still Dharma that's being, you know, transmitted. I remember once going into Sakavati when we were still doing the building work on that place. I was just visiting and I saw Bhante talking to the cooks who were in Sakavati at the time, and he was talking about the best kind of pots to use and, you know, what pots they had. And I remember him saying, he said, well, of course, you know, the really best pots are the ones are copper bottom pots, aren't they? Because of, and he was talking, and I was absolutely fascinated. It was Dharma. He was talking Dharma. He was talking about cooking, but he was talking Dharma. He was talking about the way they could express their Dharma practice in cooking by talking about the best kinds of pots. It was Dharma. It also, this particular saying, my mouth is Dharma, reminds me of something the Buddha says. An amazing passage where the Buddha is talking to his disciples and he says, you are sons of my mouth, heirs of the Dharma, not heirs of worldly things, sons of my mouth. I think there's a criticism of Brahminism there, because the Brahmins are said to have been born of the mouth of Brahma. And the Buddha is saying, ah, we're a bit different. We're even greater than that. You are born of my mouth, the enlightened one's mouth, born of the Dharma. Don't be born of worldly things. Mirarepa goes on and talks about the Sangha, the assembly of the Sangha are my cousins and nephews. The assembly of the Sangha are my cousins and nephews. It's interesting because Mirarepa's pretty solitary, but he's obviously got some sort of Sangha. He's connected up probably with all other practitioners, even the ones he can't see. He's carrying the Sangha around within him. This is quite important, I think, that when we go for refuge to the Sangha, we can identify the Sangha very, very much with the people we're with, as the sort of social group we're with. And of course, that's very important, that we have a sense of you know, that we have living spiritual friends to talk to. But, you know, if you really want Sangha, you have to activate Sangha inside yourself. You have to activate it within you. You have to be a Sangha. Paradoxically, to have a Sangha. I know that might sound a strange way of talking, and you might want to follow this up, but sometimes, you know, people can be very passive in relation to Sangha. You're not giving me Sangha. You're not doing enough for me. Well, are you activating that in you? Are you being a friend, in a sense, to yourself? Are you being a friend, not just to yourself, but to others? So there's something that needs to be activated in you. Milarepa says that the Sangha, the assembly of the Sangha, are my cousins and nephews. He's kind of talking about the extended family. You know very well that in traditional societies, it's not just the immediate family that are important. The extended family are incredibly important. I used to find this in India. So many times I'd be introduced to somebody's brother, and I think, well, how many brothers has he got? But it was cousin brother. But there's a very particular name for a particular kind of cousin brother, and a very particular kind of cousin sister, and very particular, you know, they've got names for this, all of the different people in the extended family, and these bonds between that families run very, very deep. We've lost touch with that pretty much in the modern West, which is a great shame. But within a family, the bonds run very deep. In the extended traditional family, this is why Milarepa's talking about cousins and nephews, and I think by implications, uncles and aunts and everybody else. He's trying to evoke the strength of the bonds, you know, that exist within Sangha and spiritual community. And of course it means that we have duties, you know, to the Sangha, you know, within an extended family. I used to see this in India, you know, when friends of mine, you know, if somebody turned up, you know, a distant cousin turned up at their home, well, they had to respond. You couldn't say, I can't see you now. You'd have to, Vivekaratna's laughing, you'd have to put them up and feed them, and you know, you're not going to ask them how long they're going to stay. You have a duty to them as they have a duty to you. Same in the Sangha, actually. Even stronger in the Sangha. Bhante was very fond in the early days of talking about what's known as the call of the Sangha, which is found in the monastic tradition, in the Vinaya. It said that even if you're on the verge of attaining arhatship, if somebody comes along and saying, you're called for a Sangha meeting, you've got to come to the chapter meeting, you have to go. You have to put aside your enlightenment. The Sangha comes first. The Sangha comes first. There's something very Bodhisattva-like about that. That comes before you're attaining enlightenment. Of course, you can work out the issues of that later, you know, about how that works out. But it's very, very strong, that idea. No, your brothers, sisters in the Sangha are tremendously important. It's not neurotic or anything like that. It's coming out of these deep bonds of friendship and care and concern for one another. So that's Milarepa's family. And again, he says, these are my... Wait, he says a bit more than that. He's also got friends. And these are the Dharmapalas, the protectors of the Dharma. These are Milarepa's friends and supporters. And the Dharmapalas, of course, are these fearsome deities that have been converted to Buddhist practice. The Dharmapala, though, is a kind of... Bhante speaks of the Dharmapala. If the Dakini is what you experience within the Sangha relating to one another, relating through love and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity and inspiration... The Sangha, as it faces out, especially in relation to the hostility of the world, becomes the Dharmapala, becomes very fierce and strong and protective. Not violent or anything like that, but using all intellect and skill and resources to protect what you've gained within the Sangha. So Milarepa has these Dharmapalas as his friends and supporters. Then he talks about his wife, Milarepa's wife. Of course, he's not talking about a wife that exists externally. Milarepa never married, as far as we know. He never even had a girlfriend. Never had anything like that. What does he say about his wife? My wife's ancestors are those who have gone to bliss. My wife's ancestors are those who have gone to bliss. So if you like, my wife's lineage, my wife's family, are those who have gone to bliss. Very, very important again in traditional societies that your wife, and it's true, husband as well. You know, it would be an arranged marriage traditionally. They've got to have very, very good background. you know, Vivekaratna knows all about this. They've got to have a very, very good background. You know, when you, you know, you really check out the future wife or husband's family, and you know, do they come from a good family? Because you know, traditional marriages, it's whole families joining together. I mean, we certainly don't. It's very unusual if we did that, I think, in the West. But anyway, maybe we do it a bit. But Milarepa's wife, her ancestors are those gone to bliss. They're the Sukhutas. Sukhuta is a name of the Buddha, a title of the Buddha. One who has gone to happiness. One who has gone to bliss. So Milarepa is saying his wife is prajna, is wisdom. His wife is wisdom. Not as an idea, it probably is experienced as an actual form for Milarepa, you know, a darkening form, Vajrayogini or Tara or some other mysterious, unknown female divinity. That is his wife. And she's got the most incredible background. She's, in other words, internalized, you know, all that. And she's an expert cook, is Milarepa's wife. Really, really good cook. And what's she good at cooking? She's good at cooking up bliss clarity. That's what she can cook up. So Milarepa's talking about his food, his nourishment, given to him by his wife, the feast that he enjoys on a regular basis. It's bliss clarity. It's happiness. It's bliss. It's the pleasure that comes from skillfulness. The pleasure that comes from meditation. Pleasure and bliss are so important in spiritual practice. So important, they're not to be dismissed. You know, the pleasure that comes out of meditation, the pleasure that comes out of any kind of skillful activity, is a tonic to the system. It does something to us. You know that feeling when pleasure goes through you, even kind of very ordinary worldly pleasure, it feels like a lift. It feels like a tonic. Unfortunately, a lot of the time, because we're alienated from that, we try to get it from things that can't really refresh us, and we go back again and again to it. And there are diminishing returns. That's what addiction is, of course, and you know, in whatever form. But he's talking about another kind of bliss. The bliss that is the fruit of skillfulness. The fruit of meditation. It's to be embraced. The fruit of wisdom. The fruit of internalizing, in this case, the feminine. The fruit of internalizing that someone, whatever sex, whatever gender, that you would usually live vicariously through. You think you can get bliss from that someone. You have to internalize that. You have to make it part of your psychophysical being. And of course, Milarepa has all the yogas to do that. But there's not just bliss that nourishes. There needs to be clarity. Because we know that we can get very, very caught up in bliss. You notice that in meditation sometimes. Suddenly you're getting blissful. And it's a bit like, you know, when you first learn to ride a bike. Hey, Mom, I'm doing it. And as soon as you say that when you're a kid, you fall off the bike. And it's the same in meditation, isn't it? I'm doing it. Hey, Mom. No, you probably don't call out to Mum, but maybe you do. And then you crash, come down from meditation. So you need that clear seeing, that clarity. Okay, there's bliss. But let's not let that overwhelm us. Let's enjoy, but let's not get attached. Let's go deeper. Let it unfold. Let it take us into other places, more expansive states of being. Let it take us into seeing reality clearly. He says then that her skin is lustrous. It's glowing and lustrous. It's that, and that is the lustrous skin is the two-in-one. The two-in-one, yuganada, as it's called in Sanskrit. Two-in-one, the union of bliss and emptiness. That makes her skin glow with luster. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas all are said to have a glowing, lustrous skin. The Buddha himself, even in his own lifetime, you know, even when he was an old man, would glow with the luster of bliss and emptiness. He'd radiate. And you see this sometimes, don't you? You know, you see people, they might be quite old, they might not be particularly good looking or something like that, but there's something about them. They have such a glow, such a radiance, such a sort of youth and beauty shining through, and you think, wow, they are onto something. They have something. Well, maybe it's a touch of the bliss of two in one, the union of bliss and emptiness. It's a kind of vitality that comes from Dharma practice, a vitality that's glowing through you. And her clothing, well, it's not a sari, you know, or a Tibetan rainbow apron. Her clothing is experience and realization. Bhante says this from looking up the notes in the text. It's shamatha and vipassana. That's her clothing. So this is his wife, his consort. This is such a rich, rich area, I think. There's so much to say about it, about internalizing, and I'm conscious of sort of, you know, perhaps gender issues here and maybe sexual orientation issues here. And I think we need to really reflect on this and meditate on this intensively, because it's about in you know, we can talk about the feminine and all that sort of thing, but we're talking about internalizing this kind of inner bliss and wisdom and beauty, so that we're not seeking it neurotically out there. It's something that is enriching us and taking us deeper and deeper into the Dharma. You know, Bhante really tried to talk about this in explaining years and years ago why we have single sex situations. This is can be a controversial area, complicated area. I don't particularly want to get into that. But he said on one occasion, he was talking particularly about men's situations. He says single sex is a very bad term for this. It's a very, very bad term. It doesn't really convey what we're doing, because it implies a polarization. And that isn't what's happening. You know, if you're getting together with men, what you're trying to ascend to is actually the angelic. That's the way he framed it in those days. You're trying to transcend, if you like, the one-sidedly masculine and the one-sided feminine, and emerging into this powerful being, like a deva or an angel, which he said is not a weed with wings. It's not a castrate. It's something entirely different, on a vertical, transcendent dimension. It's not to be sorted out on our ordinary level. We're talking about something else. He then, in this same seminar, he talked about the bodhisattva. Why are the bodhisattvas androgynous? Why do they have that kind of quality of being very, very powerful, but very, very feminine? He says a bodhisattva is constantly having sex within himself. What he meant by that, the polarities, he's not talking about sex fantasies or anything like that, the polarities of masculine and feminine are being constantly enjoyed and integrated within one's being, so that you are not in any way one-sided, and that is blissful. He's trying actually to point to an entirely different level of being. This is not to be talked about in terms of politics or sociology. He's talking about mystical states of consciousness. So this is, I think, also what Milarepa is trying to get at. I think one of the ways of discovering what this really is, the intense pleasure of this kind of union, if you like, you know, within oneself, although it's not separated out from the world, is the key to it, the clue to it really is metta. When you are in a state of metta, real metta, you are no longer male or female. Neither are you below male and female. You have transcended. You are in a state of union, if you like. It's intensely pleasurable, metta, when you really do it, as you radiate out. Anyway, you can, I'm sure that'll be a discussion point for you in the groups. So this is Milarepa trying to talk about singing about his wife, his maiden who is always with him, never apart from him, always this inner bliss and satisfaction and inspiration, because of course she's the darkening, always surging through him. And then he talks about his offspring. He says, awareness is my newborn babe. Awareness is my newborn babe. What I think he's getting at here with awareness is this transcendental awareness. It's this bright, fresh, sparkling, pure awareness. This is really what he's getting at. The waking up to that fresh, new, sparkling, bright awareness, as Padmasambhava calls it. This brings up the symbolism of Padmasambhava being born from a lotus, fully formed as an 8-year-old child. That's not saying that children are more enlightened than grown-ups, so that's not what we're talking about here. Just don't get into that kind of sentimentality, please. It's saying that the enlightened state, the state of pure awareness, is completely fresh, is completely new. It's absolutely pure and sparkling. And when we start to wake up, when we start to wake up to that, when that starts to emerge, we have to tend it. We have to tend it because it's a child, it's a newborn babe. We have to bring it on. What comes up here, perhaps in more practical terms, is that old teaching of beginner's mind. Remember that? When it was all very fresh. That fresh feeling when you first came along, and that sense of adventure that you had when you first came along, that moment of discovery and you see the way forward. Sometimes we get so lost on the path. We get into the ordination process and you're getting all this feedback and you're hearing these talks that seem to go on forever, you know, on a hot afternoon. When will he stop? Not right now. When will he stop? You forget that pure response when you first came along. Don't forget that. Go back to that. Recollect that. Remember that. And bring him on. Bring him on, that newborn babe. Then Milarepa says, the signs of accomplishment are my infant. The signs of accomplishment are my infant. So you don't just, the awareness in itself is not enough, that emerging awareness. Again, like the shoots in meditation, you've got to tend them. You have got to make them grow, make the awareness grow into, yes, the signs of accomplishment. You know, the awareness, when you wake up to awareness, and as you develop your awareness, it needs to be showing signs of real change. I remember years and years ago, we were asking Bhante, it was a seminar, and there were people in this particular group who were really keen on awareness. All you need is awareness. All this stuff about working on yourself, don't bother with that. You just need to be aware. That's what you need to do. And they quoted Bhante about awareness is revolutionary. So is awareness enough? And Bhante said, well, if it really was full, pure, enlightened awareness, that would be enough. You know, if you were in a particularly negative state and you brought a very intense awareness to that, that would dissolve the negativity. He said, but for most people, their awareness is very, very weak. It's very, very weak. You notice something with that bright awareness, but that's not enough. It doesn't change anything. You know, how often do people say, well, I'm aware of it, and you want to say, yeah, but what are you doing about it? You need the bhavana practices. You need to then come in with the practices to transform what you're seeing. The awareness has shone a light. Now you've got to follow that up. And the signs of accomplishment is when you remove the unskillfulness and you develop the quality in not just in meditation, but in life generally. Well, that's the growing infant. And then he says, understanding and realization are my child, is my son. Understanding and realization. So really knowing the Dharma and making that a living experience. Then that's when you give birth to the child of the Dharma. You're talking about, in a way, giving birth to yourself when there is understanding and realization. And then he says, the grown youth who holds the Dharma is my young companion. The grown youth who holds the Dharma is my young companion. So this is a very interesting way of talking. The holder of the Dharma, the Dharmadhara is my young companion. He's talking here about the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is the holder of the Dharma, the inheritor of the Dharma. So who is ever youthful. That's Milarepa's young companion. It's him, always with him, the ever-youthful Bodhisattva, holding the Dharma wherever he goes. So that's his son and family. So this is Milarepa's response to these workers. He's talked about the real farming, the real wealth, the real family, the real wife, with her wonderful glowing lustrous skin and her wonderful cooking. He's talked about his offspring, giving birth to his own children. It's very interesting as well, because after this particular story, Milarepa's talking about giving birth, if you like, to himself. He's describing that's all him. After this, he meets Rechumpa for the first time, immediately after this story. And Rechumpa, he's had other disciples, but Rechumpa becomes one of his great heart sons. It's as if in describing his own, you know, complete spiritual rebirth, that then opens up him, well, assisting others to be reborn through the Dharma, through his own mouth. I remember on the Shepherd Search for Mind seminar, Bhante said a thing that, well, one of those teachings that always, well, that I think has gone into the Ali, really impressed me. It's also why some of you might know I have quite an interest in Sufism. And some people say, have you ever been to a Sufi teacher? I said, well, why would I do that? I've got one. Bhante is my Sufi teacher. Bhante is my khwaja, my wise man. Bhante is my peer, my sheikh, because I first heard about Sufism from him. And in this seminar he was talking about the importance of spiritual friendship, of meeting spiritual friends. And he says, but what happens when you don't have spiritual friends around? What do you do? What can you do then? And he said, this reminds me of a Sufi story. And the story is of a disciple who's got to leave his teacher. He's got to leave his master. He's got to go back to his tribe, who are incredibly worldly and not interested in spiritual things at all. And he's unhappy. He's complaining to his teacher, and the teacher just cuts across. He says, beget the man you need. You must beget them. You must beget the men you need. And Bhante said he doesn't mean it literally. He means it spiritually. This man, this disciple, has got to go back to his tribe. He's got to teach the Sufism he's learned from his master, so that they will be reborn, so that he can have his spiritual friends and his spiritual community. Well, it's like that for us, I think, all the time. The more that we can activate the friends within ourselves, the more that we can activate friendship through our actions, the more friends we can enjoy within the Sangha. Anyway, Milarepa is going to go on to beget Rechumpa. He's, in fact, he adopts Rechumpa, who's his actual son, but he turns him into a great spiritual son after this. And at the end, Milarepa says, good workers of Guntang, and I, the yogin Milarepa, through the connection we have made through our conversation here, may we meet again in the glorious land of Urgyen. The glorious land of Urgyen is the land of the Dakinis. It's also Padmasambhava's pure land. It's a very wonderful aspiration that Milarepa is putting forth there. May we meet again in that land, in that place of tremendous inspiration, where there is just Dharma. All there is Dharma. That's all there is. May we meet again there. And may we meet again tomorrow for another little talk. Thank you.